I call this remote meeting of the House Higher Education Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll to determine which members are present. Please begin.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Chair Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Vice Chair Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative O'Neill, present. Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Albright, present. Representative Daniels.
Daniels, present.
Representative Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Representative Erickson, present.
Representative Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen, present.
Representative Hansen, present. Representative Heinzeman.
Present.
Representative Heinzeman, present. Representative Howard.
Howard, present.
Representative Howard, present. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, present.
Representative Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Representative Cleavorn, present. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Representative Kosnick, present. Representative Crenshaw.
Crenshaw, present.
Representative Crenshaw, present. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Meckland.
Meckland, present.
Representative Meckland, present. Representative Noor.
Noor, present.
Representative Noor, present. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Representative Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, present.
Representative Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Representative Thompson, present. Representative Mason. Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you very much. Now may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 2nd, 2022.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Christensen moves approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2022. Any discussion?
Chair.
Yes, Representative.
This is Representative Erickson, and I don't have any question of refuting the minutes. I would just request that we sometime have a hearing at which we can hear all the good things that students can talk about, because we heard so many negatives in the last go around. So I would hope that we could hear all the great things that students experience when they're in our colleges and our universities. Thank you.
Members, we have a motion, but is there any other discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 2nd, 2022 are approved. Committee members, we have first with us today, we have Mark Grant from Minnesota State College faculty. Welcome back to our committee, Mr. Grant. Please proceed.
Thank you so much. Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, Ranking Member O'Neill, and committee members. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I'm a 22-year communication studies instructor at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently help direct the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. We are the faculty union that represents more than 4,000 college instructors, counselors, and librarians on 39 campuses across the state of Minnesota. I first want to thank you for this invitation and the opportunity to share with the committee our priorities as we head into this next session. And at the risk of really screwing up, I'm going to go off script for just a second. Representative Erickson, I completely agree. Let me be the first to simply extend an invitation to any person who wants to come to any of our campuses and see some of these amazing things. I will simply say it's been a rough couple of years. And so, you know, listening to those students with the compassion that I know you did is so appreciated. Thank you. But there do continue to be great things that happen on our campuses, and I would love to host any of you at any campus that you'd like to be at. Okay, so first and foremost, I want to stress that MSCF's top priority continues to be providing all students, regardless of who they are or where they come from, with a world-class transformative education. And I know that even during the pandemic, our faculty have continued to deliver on that commitment. However, that doesn't mean that there isn't need. And I don't want to pile on either, but in many ways we are struggling. And those struggles really help reflect or direct our priorities. So first, we continue to struggle with getting the necessary resources on our campus. When I first started teaching, higher ed accounted for 14% of the state's total budget, and now it is at just 7%. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, I would be remiss if I did not remind this committee the statutory language surrounding state funding for public higher education directs 2/3 be borne by the state and only 1/3 left to tuition. As many of you know, that's a threshold that we haven't hit in over 2 decades. During that same time, we've seen tuition climb as campuses scramble to make up the shortfall. And then for a period of time, we moved into several years, 6 out of the last 9 to be exact, of lawmakers looking to address rising tuition as they should, but they did it by implementing tuition freezes while also continuing to underfund the system. I simply say that because that's the 1-2 punch that goes a long way into explaining why there continues to be pent-up need on our campuses. The campus support we receive from the state goes to fund, expand, and even develop new programs as we work to address the ever-shifting workforce landscape in Minnesota. State funding provides much-needed tuition relief for students while making sure the courses, offerings, and faculty will be there to graduate the next generation of mechanics, designers, brewmasters, welders, cybersecurity techs, nurses, as well as critical thinking, informationally literate, engaged citizens. This support also helps us attract and retain the highest quality faculty. This continues to be a challenge as market stressors highlight how college faculty salaries, quite frankly, have fallen behind other state units and fail to even keep up with inflationary forces of the broader economy. Second, MSCF also supports Minnesota State's HEPA and bonding requests. With all respect to Zoom, our students want to be on campus, in classrooms, in labs, with other students, because they know the extraordinary things that happen when we're all able to be in the same place at the same time. These dollars ensure our faculty and students have safe, healthy, and up-to-date teaching and learning spaces. Third, one of our greatest areas of struggle continues to be meeting the increasingly diverse needs of our student population. Economic instability, food and housing insecurity, work, kids, family, these are all just some of the additional stressors many of our students face as they're also attempting to work toward their educational and career goals. Throw in a pandemic, and I don't think it's hyperbole to suggest that we are at a crisis point with many of our students. Minnesota State College faculty believe the single best investment we can make to address this crisis is faculty counselors. However, for the past 15 years, we've been losing counselors at an alarming rate. From 115 in 2005 to just 51 in 2020. That's down roughly 55%. That means student to counselor ratios on some of our campuses are unimaginably high. Minneapolis College has a ratio of 7,300 students for every one counselor. And St. Paul College currently sits at 11,000 to one. That also means some of our campuses have no counselor at all. Representative Heitzman, your campus of Central Lakes currently does not have anyone assigned to do the work of a faculty counselor. I'm accompanied today by Nicole Beats, one of our dedicated counselors, and I'm going to let her talk in just a minute about what this means for our students. But I will say there has been a real shift among our broader faculty in the last few years. When the topic of funding would come up in the past, I would ask them what their needs were, and invariably their responses would focus on their classrooms and on their programs, as they rightfully should. They would say equipment or technology needs or space. Now, whenever I ask that question, regardless of what program that faculty member teaches in, the answer is resoundingly counselors. The issues that our faculty or that our students are continually facing are making their way into the classroom and are a direct impediment to their success in the classroom, and our faculty see it firsthand. This is why Minnesota State College faculty has identified as a priority this year to push for a counselor on every campus and a student-to-counselor ratio that would allow counselors to fully serve the students of Minnesota State's two-year colleges. Currently, this priority is not reflected in Minnesota State's budgetary request, although we remain hopeful that we can partner with Minnesota State and the legislature to address this critical need on our campuses. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Nicole, although I will remain on in the event that there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grant, and welcome to the committee. Nicole Beats. Please proceed and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Vice Chair Christensen and the rest of the committee. Thank you for allowing me this time. For the record, my name is Nicole Beats. I'm a counselor at Inver Hills Community College. I have been there since 2008. I have also served as the president of our statewide counselor association for all two-year community and technical college counselors. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with all of you. So what I'd like to do is just have you all take a minute and imagine yourself as a student at one of our community or technical college campuses here in Minnesota. And as you imagine this, I want you to keep in mind that you might be a working adult student zooming into classes on your lunch break, or maybe you're a single mom and you've returned to college to get a better life for yourself or your family. Or maybe you're the first person in your family who's ever gone to college and you're doing so while trying to work a couple jobs while also supporting your family. You probably commute to and from your school and you work to fit your classes into all of your other life responsibilities. And I want you to keep that in mind. And I want you to just imagine yourself in a few of the following scenarios and think about who you might go to at your college for help. So who would you go to if you were a student struggling with crippling testing anxiety and panic attacks and you're failing your math class? What if you were a parent and you lost access to your childcare and you're worried about losing your job, but also you can't stay caught up on your classes? What if you've got COVID and you had to miss work for 2 weeks without pay, and now you're worried you can't pay rent or food and you think you need to withdraw? Or what if you're a student with autism and you're struggling with navigating the social dynamics of your classroom and you need some help and coaching on how to talk to your instructor and your classmates? What if maybe you struggle with addiction and you had to drop out of classes to go to treatment and you're done and you're ready to come back, but you need someone to help you support the appeal process and support your mental health when you come back? What if you're a survivor of sexual assault and the content in one of your classes has triggered you, leading to flashbacks and panic attacks? You don't know who to talk to and how to talk to your instructor about what's going on. What if you're struggling to get out of bed every morning and you're finding yourself feeling hopeless and unmotivated to go to class? Or what if you were recently hospitalized due to a suicide attempt and you're home now, but you're trying to figure out what this means for your academic future? Who could you go to who can support your mental health while also helping you navigate that college system? What if in the last few year you've lost multiple people in your family due to gun violence, and this has made it virtually impossible for you to concentrate on your courses? Or what if you're a student of color and you've been targeted or mistreated in one of your classes due to your race? And who could you go to for confidential support to help you process that experience? Or what if you're a military veteran and you've recently returned from active duty and you're not able to sleep due to flashbacks and you're having trouble in your relationships and it's affecting your coursework due to PTSD? I share these stories to help you get a sense of the type of things our students are going through, and just so you can kind of see what's happening on our campuses every day. These are really just a normal day in the life of a faculty counselor. At Inver Hills, where I work, we're fortunate to have a workable staffing ratio on our campuses, but through my work working as the president of our statewide association, I know this is not the case on many of our campuses, as Mark has mentioned. Some of our campuses have no faculty, others have just one. And having a fully staffed counseling department really means that we can practice the holistic counseling model that allows our students to experience a more one-stop, holistic approach rather than kind of being bounced around between different departments on our campuses. When we reduce or eliminate counselors across our campus, this really forces our institutions to make hard decisions. And this means that many of my colleagues are no longer able to practice that holistic model that I mentioned. They have to sacrifice their time and cut things like mental health education or advocacy or prevention. Instead, they're limited to triage and crisis intervention rather than that holistic full service model that's ideal. And so at this time, when we're seeing more and more students struggling, we're asking for support from the legislature to partner with us and to provide funding so that we can adequately staff our counseling departments on the campuses. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Grant, would you like to add any further comments?
No, I almost said no, and then I started talking. The only thing I would add to Nicole, again, keenly aware of what's happening on our campus. Studies have shown over and over and over and over again that the success of a student on a campus is directly related to their ability to make a contact with somebody on a campus. And given the range of things that our counselors do, you are either asking faculty or you're asking students to navigate a system that they may be unaware of and essentially connect with potentially 5 to 6 people on campus to resolve the issues that they're dealing with, as opposed to a counselor. The connection that they have with a counselor greatly increases the likelihood they're going to stay in school. It greatly increases the likelihood they're going to finish. It helps with retention. It helps with our graduation rate. Once we lose a student, it's incredibly expensive to get somebody back. The cheapest thing we can do is keep the students that we have. And as a result, faculty counselors represent the biggest bang for the buck when it comes to addressing what we can do to help students navigate our system right now. So other than that, I will, like I said, I will make myself available for questions, but I have no other comments. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Members, are there any questions for our testifiers? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I just wanted to add just one really quick thing. So 1 week a year, Senator Rare and I go on vacation, only 1 week, and sometimes it's not even a week. And this time we decided to go to Bemidji and we went to Thief River Falls. And so we visited Bemidji State University and the Technical College just down the road. And then we went to Thief River Falls and went to Northland Community College, Technical and Community College. And Mr. Grant, I just want to say that we were warmly welcomed and we spent a lot of time on all three campuses and really learned a lot. And I just want to encourage any member to take them up on their offer and really go and tour. We saw everything from the aeronautical facility that they have in Thief River Falls to pipe fitter kind of things and ductwork and pipe fitting and all kinds of really interesting things that were in the trades that Senator Rarick really liked to see when we were in Bemidji. And then, but the last thing I want to say is that at Bemidji State, which is where I graduated from, the thing I found personally the most inspiring was the American Indian Resource Center. And we got to talk to their executive director and we got to talk to a lot of their staff. And why that's so important is exactly what they were just speaking about, which is they have this huge, amazing center specifically for Native American people to come feel a part of something, to continue with their culture, the language, the culture, the festivals, the ceremonies that they have, the food. They have their own kitchen where they cook Native food. And it's just really incredible. And what it's done is it's increased the graduation rates because they have that support. So I just wanted to be encouraging. And I know that we had students here before and they said a lot of things that were challenging, but I just want to know you to know that I just literally did a tour of Northern Minnesota. I didn't hit them all, but I hit 3 of the campuses and I was really left inspired and encouraged. And if we could do anything to support, that would be amazing. And yes, I know as someone who graduated from Bemidji State with a counseling degree and did some internship there at that counseling center, it's incredibly important as well. But I just wanted to leave a few words of encouragement and encourage members to actually go and visit some of the campuses because it's well worth your time.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question goes to Mr. Grant. Could you please tell me, you mentioned that on some of the campuses, there's a ratio of 7,000 to 1, and then I think you said 15,000 to 1 or 11,000 to 1?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Grant.
Sorry, yes. Yes, Representative Cleavorn. So I'm speaking specifically St. Paul Technical College. St. Paul College has one faculty counselor and an enrollment of just over 11,000. So the ratio is easy to figure out.
Okay. Could you tell me,
Representative Cleavorn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we are looking at what would be the appropriate or safe or inclusive, whatever word you want to use, ratio, is there a standard out there that would help guide us in that information?
Mr. Grant.
I think I know the answer, but at running the risk of misspeaking, if I could hand that over to Nicole, she's keenly aware of what the best practices and professional standards in that realm are.
Ms. Beats.
Putting me on the spot, I appreciate it. There's a few different numbers that we kind of reference. One number that is somewhat relevant is the school counselor, recommended school counselor ratio, and I believe that's 1 to 250. However, there are some additional organizations in college counseling that would recommend a ratio of 1 to 1,000 or maybe 1 to 1,500. I think there's an argument that the community college is a little bit different and our student body might have a higher need than what you might expect at a traditional university campus. But certainly, as you can hear from Grant, we're well below either of those numbers in our current situation.
Representative Cleburne, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
It looks like we have a couple more questions by members. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to the faculty members and the counselors for all the work they do. I personally, you know, I could not have graduated without the help of the counselors guiding me and making sure that I'm on time and also making sure that I graduate from college. So as a graduate from Minn State, I appreciate the work that you do. My key question is, what is the biggest barrier in terms of increasing, other than the funding process? We know that we have got shortages in workforce across the sectors. Ms. Beats, I don't know if you can look into what are the main challenges in creating more pathways and more individuals joining to be counselors in colleges.
Ms. Beats.
I think that it is really funding. I think that I know many colleagues that I've worked with in the past who have done kind of temporary counselor roles and would have loved to continue on in a permanent capacity, but because there wasn't a position open or, you know, things weren't filled, there wasn't the opportunity. So I do think that funding is definitely something. I think our campus administrators have to make really hard decisions, and I think they're trying to do a lot with what they have available to them, but I think it's just a budget constraint is one of the primary reasons.
Representative Noor, do you have a follow-up?
Just a quick one. I know the funding is one of the biggest challenge. If we are, you know, to do something about it, you know, we've been talking about numbers 1 to 11,000, 1 to 1,000 ratio and all that. Given that we are facing those challenges, what advice, other than the funding, will you give to this committee so that we can take a look at that whole picture of what else is needed to make sure that our students are ready, not only to come to college, and you've talked about all the struggles with many things, you know, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, and all those things. What else should they be equipped with in order for us to be looking at the next chapter of how we can increase the number of counselors for colleges?
Ms. Beats, did you want to answer that question?
I'm not sure I have a great answer. I think there are many things, and I would love to continue conversations. I love the opportunity for us to continue to work together. And if you have ideas or questions, I'd love to talk more about it. I think I'd also lean into hearing what the students have to say and what our students are asking for. I know on our campus, you know, one of the things I kind of co-lead our campus food pantry. And so we've done a lot of work on our campus to work on food insecurity, but housing is really one of the biggest things. And that's the thing that keeps me up at night, because I don't know, I can figure out how to get students food, but getting them affordable housing is hard. And so that, you know, is all connected to mental health, right? You know, if our students don't have a place to stay. So I think community partnerships have been great. We've been able to do some community partnering and building on our community resources. So I think leaning into those things are helpful also, while also adequately staffing our counseling department. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
Representative Noor.
To some extent. Thank you so much, Ms. Bates. We'll have more further conversation on this issue. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And then we were going to try to wrap up at 3:25. And so I have two more members that have questions. So we will go to Representative Erickson and then Representative Mason. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Grant, have counselors replaced advisors? Because students have told me that they do have advisors in at least some of the degree areas. Has that gone away?
Mr. Grant.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Yes. No, it's more times the opposite. Counselors have been replaced by advisors, and advisors serve an important function on campus. But as it is with lots of those functions on campus, their lane tends to be quite narrow and quite limited. And so what we find is that the students are served best when they can go to a faculty counselor who that faculty counselor may ultimately get them in touch with an advisor. They may get them in touch with a financial aid advisor. They may get them, they may act as a go-between between them and a member of program faculty between, or reach out to their program advisor in addition to, you know, finding things like addressing food insecurity and stuff like that. So we've taken a large role, an expansive, holistic approach represented by counselors, and we've attempted to replace them with advisors who do what they do really well, but they do, quite honestly, a fraction of what counselors do, and it leaves our it leaves many of our students wanting, quite frankly.
Representative Erickson, do you have follow-up?
Sure, no, that answers my question. Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Representative Mason.
Very much. And I do appreciate the testimony that we heard today. And obviously, in many cases, it's extremely concerning. And I just, and this is not the first committee I've had today where I've been concerned about the underfunding that we've been doing as a state. So I guess I would just like to encourage people, we need to get the information out about how we are not doing the adequate funding so that our facilities can truly operate at the way that we expect them to. And it's, you know, and we obviously don't have a lot of time in this session to get this done, but we really need to get that out. The reason I'm saying it's an emergency or essential is the fact that I'm sure others are getting the same letters from people saying that they're, because they know about the money that we have, the surplus, they're thinking that we've got too much money, and yet we have so many holes that we have been underfunding for years. So just a word of the fact that we really need help in getting across the message. We need to do better for our institutions. Thank you.
And thank you. And we're going to wrap up now. Mr. Grant, did you have anything else to add?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we're going to move on to Jonathan Bone, Director of Public Affairs for the Interfaculty Organization. Welcome back to our committee, Mr. Bone. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, my name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the Interfaculty Organization. We represent approximately 4,000 faculty, coaches, and counselors at the seven Minnesota State universities. And to go along with Representative Erickson's comments, I would like to start with some good news. And the good news is that we are ready and willing to help you address Minnesota's workforce shortage needs. And I would argue we are the only system in the state that at the scale that's needed can work to address those needs. Just as a data point, 64% of all students in Minnesota that are pursuing an undergrad credential are attending one of the Minnesota state institutions. That includes 8,800 veterans, 72,000 low-income students, 66,000 students of color, and we award more than 37,000 credentials each year. And we're ready to work with you. And with that, I just want to get in quickly to a couple of the highlights that we've been working on this year. First, our contracts. I know Representative O'Neill had an opportunity to hear about this in the joint subcommittee, but we have come to an agreement with the system. As many of you remember from last year, in light of retrenchments and continued budget cuts and elimination of sports programs and educational programs, we took a self-imposed pay freeze the first year of the biennium. And we settled for the second year at 4%, slightly lower than some of our other state employee unions. Modest but meaningful increase. And that concession the first year ended up saving our campuses millions of dollars and was really done to help stabilize campus budgets through an extraordinarily difficult time. However, we still have campuses now that are coming back to us this year with further retrenchments, retrenchment being a reduction or an elimination of a tenured faculty position. And then I want to highlight one really important language item that was included in the agreement. It was language that we proposed that advances the system's goal of Equity 2030. This language would provide a faculty member continuous improvement toward the elimination of education equity gaps as a highly valued criteria, as one of the five criteria toward tenure and promotion. So this new language also adds that evidence of achievement in the five criteria may include activities intended to help close educational equity gaps and provide faculty to normally engage in these activities intended to help close educational equity gaps. And as far as I'm aware, and I've done a little bit of research on this, we are the first faculty union in the country that has built equity and inclusion work into our contract as an expectation of our members and as a requirement that the administration must recognize that work as valuable to the university and the community. I want to talk quickly about the supplemental budget. As you heard from MSCF, as you heard from the students last time, campuses are struggling. Repeatedly, you've heard over and over, our state college universities are struggling. We, since 2003, with a few exceptions, our state governments failed to maintain the level of investment in higher ed to cover just basic inflationary increases. And now we find ourselves in a predictable dilemma where our workforce has serious gaps that hinder the opportunity for continued economic and equity growth. A shortage of qualified nurses, teachers, police officers, accountants, and the list goes on and on. The students attending our institutions are the people that fill these jobs. Shifts in state spending away from higher ed have led to dramatic increase in student debt and unfortunately put post-secondary education out of reach for a lot of low and middle class Minnesotans. Last year, we supported the system's request, $75 million and 3% tuition increase. And even if that request was fully funded, which unfortunately it wasn't, that still was only enough to cover inflation. And that was before anyone really cared what inflation was. And our faculty have been forced to do more with less for two decades. The impacts of state budget cuts and rising tuition have become clear. Our universities struggle to innovate. We struggle to invest. We struggle to meet the needs of our students, to offer the courses and support that they need to successfully complete their degrees. And ultimately, our state's left an entire generation of students behind and offered no support to prepare for the students that are arriving today and in the coming years. Our student body, the makeup of our student body has been changing and will change dramatically if Minnesota's gonna continue to move forward. Yep, here we are again in front of the committee begging for less than what we need. We're asking for the $55 million for a tuition freeze and to fill the structural deficit left by last year's budget. And then $5 million to address student needs. I just want to run through a couple of the numbers real quick from last session that we shared. 26 tenured faculty at Morehead were laid off last year. Three faculty and counselors, as you heard from the previous discussion at St. Cloud State, were retrenched last year. We had 10 programs eliminated at MSU Morehead in the last 5 years. 53 permanent faculty positions at Winona State have been lost. At Mankato, they reduced 25 permanent faculty lines last year just due to attrition. St. Cloud State's laid off 11 tenured faculty members, and we've just heard that the administration is planning another round of retrenchments this year. So we will continue to have program reductions, course offering reductions, faculty and counselor reductions at our campuses. And those were prior to COVID, except for the most recent cuts at St. Cloud. So we need your help. When the legislature provides funding, when the legislature does not provide funding, the only place for us to turn is students. And if we continue to cut in the spirit of keeping costs down, we're gonna continue to have fewer faculty and reduce the student support services like counselors. And ultimately we end up with fewer nurses, cops, accountants, and everything else that the state needs. One other issue, moving on to campus safety. So we have internally in the IFO a faculty of color safety work group that helps the leadership of the union identify issues that are important to faculty of color and to make sure that they feel safe on our campuses. And one thing that they identified that they would like us to work with you to fix is that currently under law, our campuses can only develop policies which restrict students and employees from carrying firearms on campus. If we have a visitor on campus that is not affiliated with the university in any way, they are allowed to carry a firearm if they have conceal and carry, and we cannot, a campus cannot develop a policy that would restrict them from doing that. And, you know, in recent years, we've had an increase in assaults and other criminal behavior on our campuses. And frankly, it's only a matter of time before someone ends up dead. And our faculty are concerned that it's going to be them or one of their students. And so we're going to ask that you consider passing language, which would allow, it's permissive language, which would allow a campus to develop similar to the reasonable request that private businesses have, would allow a campus to develop a policy to restrict visitors from carrying firearms on campus. And the other thing that I just want to take a second to talk about is we are a proud member of the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. Our faculty have a keen understanding that to reach the goals of increasing the teachers of color in our E12 system, we must also create opportunities for those prospective teachers to learn from a faculty member at a university of color or from another marginalized group. The IFO continues to partner with system leadership to develop intentional strategies to recruit and retain faculty of color and other marginalized faculty, including recently developing our own internal equity and inclusion strategic plan, which outlines multiple ways that the union can do better and ways that we can work with the system to ensure that our faculty feel safe and welcome and valued. So those are just a couple of our legislative priorities I wanted to highlight. I appreciate the time as always, and I'll stop now and take any questions that the committee may have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I see we have a couple members having questions. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it'll come to no one's surprise that I believe in investing in our state educational systems is really a strong investment in our state and in our state's economy and in the people and families of our state. But you mentioned the institutions are educating our students for careers. So I'm just going to ask you, I know my email box is really full about nurses, about law enforcement, and teachers, right? We're hearing about a lot of shortages all across those spaces. Could you just maybe give us a 30,000 foot overview of what type of jobs you prepare your students for and what their role, what that contribution to our state might be?
Mr. Bowen.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Cleavorn, thanks for that question. I have a spreadsheet I'm just going to try and find really quick because I have some numbers that are important to that question. Okay, so yes, many people think of our technical colleges and our community colleges as a place where, you know, you have the welders and others with certifications of some kind to work in an industry. But what often is lost at the university level is that in order to be a nurse, you need to be certified. In order to be a teacher, you need to have a license. And an accountant, you need to have a license. So we do similar work with licensed careers, and many of our graduates fall within those areas. So as an example, half of all the business grads in the state come out of our institutions. 3/4 of all the nurses come from a in-state institution. 9 out of 10 manufacturing jobs that require some credential are a in-state institution. Half of all teachers, 8 out of 10 of law enforcement graduates in the state, half of all the IT grads in the state. So as I said before, we really believe that we are the partner that can most quickly and most effectively help the state work through the dramatic shortage in the workforce. But in order to do that, we need your help as well.
Representative Cleavorn, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's more just a quick comment. You know, as we're looking at long-term care and the aging of Minnesota, you know, we saw with the funds the limited funds that were available to help get certified nursing assistants into our long-term care facilities, just helping our students overcome that small amount of tuition really put a lot more people in a better place for earning a living for their family, but also for caring for our families. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you. Representative Heitzman.
Oh, there we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions I hope that we could address. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I'm wondering, on the point of firearms, I'm wondering I have a few questions. I would say specifically, it seems interesting. The comment was made that just anyone can walk into a campus, any stranger, and conceal carry a firearm. I think that's missing a lot of context. Obviously, a concealed carry permit is quite a process to achieve in Minnesota. So I think that clarification needed to be made. In addition to that, I would point out that there's numerous thousands of students in our MnState system who are concealed carry permit holders themselves. And our MnState system does not recognize their constitutional right to defend themselves. And if we're going to actually work on a problem, which was specifically brought up, an increase of violence, why are we choosing to further disarm rather than allow people to defend themselves? If there is a rise in crime, it only makes sense that students' constitutional right to defend would be honored on campus as opposed to stripped from them. I'd like a reaction to that.
Mr. Bowen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Heintzman, and I respect your position. Our position is that whether someone is a visitor to the campus and has a conceal and carry, we believe it's in the best interest of the safety of our faculty and our students that they keep their firearm in their car in the parking lot or not bring it with them. And so currently, yes, the system has a policy which would restrict a student from carrying on campus. We have some university campuses that do provide gun lockers for students living in the dorms so that they don't have to keep their firearms in their cars, which is also dangerous, as you know. Under state law, the system is allowed to develop a policy for students and for employees. And so we follow that, and we would prefer that a visitor to campus, whether they, if they have a conceal and carry, that they just leave their firearm in their car. And that's the position that our faculty have taken, and that's what I'm here advocating for today.
Representative Heintzman, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. It is honestly a shock to me that the way that your organization would respond to a rising crime would be to in defense of your previous statement, further suggest that students should be stripped of their constitutional rights when walking onto your campus. And finally, I would ask if you do have any data to suggest that there are any related examples of those that you are apparently afraid of walking on campus with a concealed carry permit committing a crime.
Mr. Bowen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The one example that I can think of off the top of my head is there was a woman in Marshall who was upset at the mask mandate at the beginning of COVID. And her daughter was a student at the school, and she entered the school property. She was disruptive in a while a course was happening that her daughter was in. She was escorted off the property by police. And it was my understanding that at that point she was carrying conceal and carry. She was disruptive. She was loud, and ultimately was, I think, charged with a misdemeanor at that time for her behavior. That's one example that I can remember off the top of my head. Most recently with a student, we did have a student that committed suicide or died by suicide in the library at MSU Mankato using a firearm. So it's not unheard of that it happens on our campuses. And what we would like to do is just provide an opportunity for our faculty of color and other faculty and students to feel more safe.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, those are that comment or response is unfortunately characteristic of an incredibly uninformed testimony today, based on zero facts before us today. The recommendation was made that this is a problem, and a recommendation was made to our committee. There's no data, so that there was a off the top of my head comment. So no newspaper story. No hard evidence of any kind of issue related to this. And here we are presented with this from what I would hope was a reputable organization. I would suggest that in the future, bring your facts. Disarming students is not the answer to this difficult challenge that you are describing, if it did exist. That is their constitutional right. And further disarming the public in Minnesota is not the solution.
Okay, Representative Cleburne, and then we're going to wrap this up and move on to our next testifiers. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this goes back to the education issue. I know that in the last couple of years, we've asked about textbooks and we've asked about how we can get less expensive textbooks and teaching materials into the hands of our students. And I'm wondering, you know, I know IFO was involved at that, and many of your professors were, our instructors were also involved with that. Could you just kind of give us an update as to where we are with the textbooks, please?
Mr. Bowen, if you could briefly answer Representative Cleburne, that would be great. Thank you.
Yep. Madam Chair, I'll stick to the one thing that was discussed the last few biennia, and that's around open educational resources and Z degrees. So we've done some exciting work at the university level. There are programs that are in the process of developing Z degrees. Typically, Z degrees are considered to be more effective at the community colleges. But we have had some programs, some faculty work together within their program to develop an opportunity for Z degrees at the university level. And then also we've had a number of faculty who have applied to the program that was created by the legislature for them to be compensated to develop their own open educational resource materials that then can be shared around the world, but most specifically amongst their colleagues. So their colleagues know that these are high quality materials that can be trusted and used in their courses and ultimately for free. We have seen outstanding savings when even just one book is developed. And we hope to continue to do more of that and save students real money on materials.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cleaver, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for that work. As I always say, it's the entire cost of tuition that we have, or the cost of attendance, not just tuition. So this is a great help to our students. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being here today, Mr. Bowen, and I appreciate your testimony. Now we are going to move on to the University of Minnesota. We have a presentation from the University of Minnesota. Joining us first is President Joan Gable. Welcome back to our committee, President Gable. Please introduce yourself and to the committee and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, members of the committee. My name is Joan Gable. I'm the president of the University of Minnesota. I'd also like to acknowledge that streaming or joining the stream, we have a couple members of our Board of Regents, Regent McMillan, and I also believe Regent Spigum is streaming or maybe joining us later. And several of my colleagues are on the line as well, some of whom you'll hear from and some are available for questions. Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations, Myron Franz, Brian Bohr, Dean of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resources. I'll introduce them in a few moments when it's their turn. Of course, J.D. Burton, our Chief Government Relations Officer, is here. Mike Bertelson, VP for Facilities, and Julie Tonneson, VP and Budget Director, all here to either present or answer questions as the case may be. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find the right light so that I don't have a weird stripe across my face. Apologies, members of the committee. I will start I will start with appreciation for your time today, for your support, for all the work that we do together. All of the things that we will be talking about today come out of our collaboration, our shared goals of serving our students, of providing excellent education for our state, and also for advancing the state in strategic ways that we're uniquely positioned to do and have done in this longstanding partnership. So it's a pleasure to be here and have a chance to talk with all of you about this. The supplemental budget proposal we're presenting to you today is all coming out of our strategic plan that we call MPACT 2025. We just completed the first year of the plan. And as you may recall, in the development of the plan, you all were very important contributors in terms of the thought processes and feedback. The plan is intended to hold the university accountable, to provide easy access to measures, transparency initiatives, and an easy way for you all to see what we're working towards and where we are today in terms of our impact. So ultimately, this strategic plan is guiding our choices. It's guiding our choices in terms of what we're presenting before you today. It reflects our priorities and our needs and what's underway in terms of supporting your research university, your land grant, world-class innovative institution that is committed then also to being accessible and serving all Minnesotans. So just a couple of things about that plan and some of the outcomes on that plan before we get into the details, just so that you're aware of some of the context. Many meaningful and transformative outcomes already from this past year. We welcomed the most Minnesotan freshman class in over half a century, the most diverse class in our history. We've increased our four-year graduation rate to its highest point ever. We are the most improved doctoral granting institution in terms of graduation rates in the country. And we are at the top of the Big Ten, except for Northwestern University. We've taken tremendous steps to contain student debt, and we're really just getting started. Over 40% of our students across the system, 41% to be precise, graduate, leaving us debt-free, completely debt-free. And our average debt is well below the national average for students who do take debt. How have we done this? Is by keeping tuition low. The actual cost of attendance, what we call net cost of attendance, some of the lowest in the state. All tuition increases have been below the rate of inflation. And we've been targeting scholarship support and programmatic support for the families that need it the most. For example, with our Promise program for Minnesota families who make $50,000 or less, the program that we launched for our Native American students called the Native American Promise Program, along with others, some of which are available because of your support, some of which are federal, some of which are philanthropic. And we pull all of that together to keep costs down. So we've been really thinking about how to deliver on accessibility and affordability for students. We've been working actively on getting our administrative overhead down, but we've been very careful not to let that affect quality or impact. So just a couple of examples in that space. We've set a record with over $1 billion in research expenditures. Research expenditures makes it sound like we spent $1 billion. That's expenditures that other people have made on us, investments that people have made in the university to conduct the research that we conduct. So that's over $1 billion coming in and then creating economic impact for the state, in addition to the outcomes of the research, lots of which you saw very, very tangibly during the pandemic around cures and tests and other things that came out of that research. We've used this very interesting time, which has inspired some really creative thinking, to launch some new programs that are leveraging technology in the highest workforce need areas like Next Gen Med. This is our program in Rochester in partnership with Google and the Mayo Clinic. Next Gen Ag is coming soon, which will have a similar impact in the agri-food space. We've strengthened our relationships with our tribal partners through some really active engagement with MIAC and several other activities, that some of which you'll be hearing about today. All of this, of course, like all of us, while navigating this pandemic, which has just been quite a thing, hasn't it? And has had a very big impact on higher ed in lots and lots of ways, some of which were very challenging and some of which were really difficult and some of which opened our eyes to some opportunities that we are delighted to share with you and keep you posted on. So we recognize that this is a unique time with a significant surplus unexpectedly, and we're all thinking about what that means and the opportunities that creates and some of the challenges that that creates, because these things always have two sides to the coin, or lots of coins in this case. And we know that this is a really transformational moment in how the universe and how the state can think about its investment in itself and in its people and in, we hope, higher education as well. So we've submitted a legislative request that's really focused on the future, channeled through the initiatives and proposals in the strategic plan. So its focus is tied directly to that mission in terms of potential impact to the state and how we seek to accelerate these strategies that make us best able to serve locally, but at world-class levels, as you should expect from us as your land-grant research university. So you'll hear about details on HEPR, of course. You'll hear about the Twin Cities Chemistry Undergraduate Teaching Lab and the University of Minnesota Duluth's Science Building Renewal. You'll also hear about funding we're seeking to reduce the cost of attendance burden for Minnesota resident undergrads, like the increasing support we're seeking for the Promise Program. You'll hear about public safety and security. You'll hear about sustainability on our campuses, and you'll hear about our research mission, as you do every time. But then you'll hear about one of the projects in some detail that we're really excited about in our goals to develop and deploy FARM, which is an acronym that stands for the Future of Animal Agricultural Research in Minnesota, FARM. This is a project that you have materials on that's intended to drive innovation around food and agriculture. And we have Dean Bohr here, he'll go into some detail. We have really exciting things happening with the Twin Cities Health Discovery Hub project. We have really exciting things happening in Duluth with an academic health center in the new health corridor up north, anchored by Essentia and St. Luke's, and what that does for our ability as your clinical care training epicenter on our own and also in partnership with several of the Minnesota State campuses to really make sure that there is high quality clinical care and well-trained clinicians throughout the state, especially in the way that Duluth is regionally positioned to serve greater Minnesota in ways we've never been able to before. So we know all this is bold. It's a big and unique ask during a unique time, but it's all tied to the way in which we are committed to serving the state at top-notch levels. And if not now, when? This is the time to really think about a strategic link and a refreshing of that link between the state and the university. And so we're very grateful to be able to talk to you about how we deepen those ties and how we transparently look for impact in ways that the state needs it the most and the university is the best position to fulfill. So I really want to thank members of the committee who've already taken leadership roles within our legislative request by introducing some of the legislation needed to move this forward, including Representative Christensen, Representative Sandsteed, Representative Noor, and Representative Cleavorn. I thank you all very much in particular, and also the committee as a whole as we take these shared steps forward. I'm really grateful that we have the chance to talk about all this today. I'm delighted we're in the position to be thinking about how we might be in the best position to think about the future. It's refreshing to be having this conversation in this way. And so, Madam Chair, at this time, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to Senior Vice President for Finance and Operation, Myron Franz, who will go through some of the detail.
Well, welcome to the committee, Myron Franz. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Glad to, Madam Chair. Myron Franz, Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations. Good afternoon, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, Ranking Member O'Neill, members of the committee and committee staff. It's a pleasure to be here today and to talk about the details. As you know, I like to talk about details. So there's a lot of detail here. So what I'm going to try to do is kind of walk you through the different areas and of the request so you get a sense of the different areas, and I'll do some detail, but I want to make sure we have time for Dean Bohr and questions. So the first thing I want to kind of do is a breakdown of the request. You can see here that we put this request into three different categories. The first category is our recurring investments, about $75 million, which accounts for 8% of the total request. The majority of this recurring request is for a $60 million proposal to increase scholarships for students, as President Gable mentioned. It also includes $5 million for student services, and the remaining $10 million is for safety and security proposals. Now, the remaining 92% of the university request is divided between two types of non-recurring requests. First, $175 million in new non-recurring projects. Now, these projects are not generally considered to be eligible for general obligation bonding. Projects in this category will enhance safety, security, and sustainability, and I'll summarize those in just a moment. The second category of the one-time investments is a $685.6 million request that includes projects that we traditionally consider to be eligible for general obligation bonding. Now, these include new facilities, design funds, and capital renewal needs that we all refer to as HEPR, or Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement. The university's capital request is by far the largest component of our overall request and is reflective of the significant capital renewal needs we have at the university. But let's go into the first category. So I want to talk about first a supplemental recurring request of $75 million. So if we go to the next slide, our recurring request of $75 million supports our strategic plan priorities, as President Gable mentioned. $10 million of the request is in the public safety and security area, which will help fund the university's commitment to providing a safe campus environment through advanced programming in public safety, student health, IT infrastructure, and health and safety. The proposal includes system-wide cameras, building access, alarm monitoring, and personnel to manage the operations and maintenance of those security systems. This proposal will also fund additional uniformed security and safety escort personnel, as well as additional police officers and first responders. Now, this $5 million in student services will enhance our mental health resources, the academic and advising support, and proactive outreach and service to students. These funds really are a result of the demands that we're finding from the students for more of these services to help them succeed and graduate on time. Now, the third component, let's go to the next slide. The third component really is our proposal to increase access to the university and to reduce the cost of attendance burden for Minnesota residents. And this is a $60 million request in total. We're committed to providing financial support for students who are admitted to the university but cannot afford to attend. In addition to federal grants, like the Pell Grant, the Minnesota State Grant Program, and donor support, we have numerous system-wide scholarship and financial aid programs designed to help meet our goal of affordability for admitted students. Now, as a result of this commitment, our net cost of attendance for Minnesota undergraduates is approximately $16,000 per year at the very low end of Minnesota universities and colleges. You'll recall that the net cost of attendance is a cost of attendance, the full cost of attendance, minus the total gift aid. Now, despite the array of resources that we have, we know there's more that we need to do to help students afford college and avoid garnering a lot of debt. The university is focused on innovative approaches to support more students with financial need, including historically underrepresented students, and to reduce student debt. One of the major scholarship programs is the University of Minnesota Promise Program. This supports about 13,000 Minnesota families on an annual basis. Now, the Promise Program provides income-eligible Minnesota undergraduate students funds to support their collegiate aspirations. Now, for example, a freshman with a family household income of $120,000 or lower could receive between $300 to $4,000 each year for 4 years, depending upon the income level. The university scholarship proposal here includes adding $30 million in recurring funding to expand the existing system-wide Promise Program in two directions, with the ultimate goal to reduce student debt. First, the proposal will increase the amount of support offered to students currently participating in the program, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,100 per year to $2,100 per year would be the increase depending upon the income level. Second, if this request is funded, the number of Minnesota families supported through the Promise Programs would increase over 13,000 to 17,000 across all the campuses. This is by expanding the upper income threshold for eligibility of the Promise Program. Ultimately, we would minimize student debt with this program, we believe, and reduce the amount of the families have to borrow to attend the University of Minnesota. Now, the second component of the university's proposal for $30 million recurring funds is to create a new Greater Minnesota Scholarship to attract and retain students to our campuses in Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Rochester. The new scholarship would provide $3,000 to $4,000 in year one to every Minnesota resident entering as a freshman at those campuses, and an additional $4,000 to $5,000 for each of those same students spread over enrollment years 2 through 4. This program is over and above other existing aid programs, including the Promise programs. We estimate that this program could support 8,500 to 9,500 students per year when fully phased in. This scholarship would provide, we believe, strong financial incentive for students to enroll on these campuses and enable more Minnesotans to attend the University of Minnesota. So let's go to the supplemental one-time request of $175 million. As I mentioned at the beginning, these are the kinds of projects that are not general obligation bond projects, but they fit within the category of infrastructure investments on a one-time basis. The University of Minnesota has continuously prioritized campus safety to enhance the university experience and to support the campus community. The university is recommending an investment of $100 million in additional safety and security personnel. The $10 million I mentioned earlier was on the recurring money for the ongoing support for safety and security. This $90 million is really designed to help with the secure and provide safety infrastructure for all 5 campuses. Safety systems and emergency responders are always more successful, or usually more successful, when our campuses have industry recognized cameras, access, and lighting systems in place. This part of the request also helps to better secure unauthorized access to the university's more sensitive information systems and helps protect the data contained in them by mitigating current vulnerabilities and by building an architecture of infrastructure that processes that will help protect us against cybersecurity threats in the future, something we live with, all of us live with every day. Now, the $85 million sustainability proposal is our plan for building a fully sustainable future. This is consistent with our strategic plan that President Gabel mentioned, but it really is, we want to demonstrate leadership in sustainability and advancing environmental research. $75 million of this funding would be for energy and sustainability planning, on-campus solar, conversion of campus vehicles from gas to electric, and a significant investment in geothermal or hot water heating for the campuses. Geothermal is more efficient and addresses one of the largest components of the university's carbon footprint, heating and cooling our buildings. And the last $10 million of this proposal would be for funding that would support applied research at the Natural Resources and Research Institute. The funding would expand laboratory space for aquatic ecology and water management, forestry and wildlife studies, and mineral research in Duluth. The request will also fund a new mineral processing and metallurgy building in Coleraine with equipment and capabilities to support the Iron and Minerals of the Future research program in partnership with state, federal, and private industry leaders. Finally, I want to talk to you a little bit about the overall capital request. Another priority of the board has been our capital request. Our 10-year capital renewal need is about $5 million and growing each year. We are asking the state to provide $400 million of capital renewal funding, or HEPR, in this request. As a reminder, we have over 30 million square feet of buildings. We have about 900 roofs. We have about 26 million square feet of windows, which is about 540 football fields. We have over 450 elevator units. We have over 1,000 accessibility projects that we need to tackle for restrooms, entrances, fountains, and railings. We have asbestos in some of the older buildings, and we have fire sprinkler issues in some of the buildings. So we have a lot to do, and we need your help. The additional capital renewal request would go a long way to helping addressing these critical needs and keep our faculty, students, and staff safe, warm, and dry. We're also asking $72 million to renovate the 95-year-old Fraser Hall to create a 117,000 square foot modern chemistry teaching laboratory serving students from every college in the Twin Cities campus. This building would provide 18 active learning laboratories and service high demand STEM courses with space for lab preparation, academic support, and collaborative learning. I know a number of legislators have been through the current chemistry facility in Wilson Hall, and it is extremely outdated, to say the least. I would have recognized it from my time in high school chemistry, and that's not That's not a good idea. So we really need your help to do that. But by the way, thank you for the design funding that you you put into the 2020 bonding bill. That project now is ready to go. It's been designed, and we can literally start building that facility once you all pass a bonding bill with this proposal in it. We're also asking for $106 million to redesign a 70-year-old obsolete chemistry building on the Duluth campus. We can use that for higher priority science and technology programs, especially computer science and earth and environmental science programs, as well as some lab space. We're asking $60 million for the farm project that President Gabel mentioned that Dean Boer is going to talk about in just a minute. And we're also asking for $140 million in state funding for a health discovery hub. Many of you will recall that the Blue Ribbon Commission of 2015 for the governor's Blue Ribbon Commission recommended two different buildings. One of them was the Health Sciences Education Center, which is a beautiful facility that opened in 2020. And this is the second building recommended in that proposal. This would improve Minnesotans' access to advanced treatments, state-of-the-art care, and cross-collaborative health teams. And then finally, I want to mention the academic design for the Academic Health Center. We're asking for $12 million for design for the new academic health facility in the Duluth Medical District. This is a follow-up from the 2019 legislative designation of $97.2 million in bonding toward improvements in the Duluth Regional Exchange District, now referred to as the Duluth Medical District. This is for the benefit of Essentia, St. Luke's, and all the people in that region and Duluth. This was in partnership, this original program in 2019 was in partnership with the City of Duluth, which has invested $10 million in public improvement. The investment by University of Minnesota here would be consistent with the improvements for this area and would further really enhance the regional impact of healthcare delivery in that particular region. The proposed university facility would include teaching spaces and clinical research spaces that would be designed and built based upon the needs of the university community and the regional community there in Duluth and the greater Duluth area. We're really excited about this opportunity to partner with our friends in Duluth, both at the medical district and with the University of Minnesota campus at Duluth, which will then have more space to redesign. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like now to see if Dean Boer can come forward and talk about the farm project. Oops, you're on mute, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, you're on mute.
Sorry, I'm on mute. Okay. Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Dean Boer.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Members of the committee, I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences here at the University of Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to provide an informational presentation on farm as part of the university's capital request. I do want to recognize and thank also the University of Minnesota Board of Regents and President Gabel for their strong support of Minnesota's agriculture, food, and natural resource systems in advancing what we see as a very, very exciting project for all of Minnesota. Next slide, please. Minnesota is a global leader in agriculture and food systems, and the University of Minnesota has been a partner in that since its founding. Our agriculture and food research programs have contributed to discoveries that have ranged from improvements in dairy cattle genetics through innovations in embryo transfer to developing new crop varieties from apples to wheat, and including new perennial crops such as kernza that provide new revenues for farmers and improve environmental outcomes. Throughout our history, we've also developed the talent Minnesota needs to enable our farms, businesses, and supporting government and other partners to thrive and grow by offering science-based curriculum in food and agriculture. Key platforms delivering these results are the fields and facilities we operate that include our 10 research and outreach centers across the state of Minnesota, as well as on our St. Paul campus right here in the heart of the Twin Cities. However, these living laboratories need significant modernization and investment if we're going to continue to advance Minnesota's competitiveness as a global leader in agriculture. Next slide, please. FARM represents that opportunity to invest in a state-of-the-art integrated research platform that ties our animal agricultural and crop systems research together into a one health contract that recognizes agriculture, food, and the environment, as well as the implications for human health as a system. By developing FARM as an intentional integrated design, We can deliver a one-of-a-kind system of leapfrog innovations such as remote sensing, robotic technologies, and biological technologies in modern production facilities that capture subtle interactions we can use to identify and analyze some of the most challenging problems facing agriculture and deliver those solutions to farmers and businesses where needed. Next slide. In partnership with Minnesota State's Riverland College, Community College in Austin, Minnesota, FARM represents a vertical educational opportunity for advancing next-gen talent for all of agriculture and food systems, as well as environmental aspects. FARM's educational vision includes K-12, two-year technical degrees, bachelor's, as well as graduate degrees, and outreach to the broader community. It fully complements FARM's integrated experiential research strategy and is equally critical for delivering the talent to drive our future agricultural systems and rural communities' development in today's modern agricultural sector. Next slide. This past year, we completed a feasibility of the FARM vision, and that feasibility confirmed the need and opportunities for investment in FARM, and it serves as a basis for advancing a full pre-design for the system, which we plan to undertake in the fall of 2022. The successful feasibility evaluation affirmed a partnership opportunity with the Hornell Foundation that resulted in their pledging $60 million in support of FARM, and pending the success of the pre-design, site selection, and additional investment in business partnerships to complete the projected $220 million project. The capital request by the University of Minnesota for $60 million from the state of Minnesota is a major step forward to support this Minnesota-wide effort to drive future competitiveness in Minnesota's agricultural economy. Next slide. As part of that economic impact, FARM itself is an $18 million per year investment in annual outcomes from the operations. And in addition, that results in $33.5 million in indirect impacts to the broader community and state through employment opportunities, through investment in other businesses who partner in this, and other aspects of our operations. In addition, I peer-reviewed at the University of Minnesota beyond this project has shown that investments in agricultural research and development result in an additional $40 in economic return for every dollar invested. That goes beyond the operation aspects that's presented here. This state investment will catalyze additional work we're doing to seek investment from other public and private agriculture, food, natural resource partners, as well as through operational efficiencies and cash flows redirected from current depreciated assets. Together, this public-private and university partnership has the potential to reinvigorate the living laboratory facilities we need to successfully serve Minnesota's farmers, businesses, and rural communities. Thank you for the opportunity to present this exciting investment vision for Minnesota, and I welcome discussions that coming forward throughout the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. President Gable, are we going back to you now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for questions, I don't have additional comments.
Okay, well, thank you. Members, are there any questions that you'd like to ask today to university regarding their presentation? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually waiting to see if someone from my membership group, the other members wanted to speak, but I will go ahead. So I was at the Regent meeting in December, and as everyone except for one presenter is aware, Senator Rarick and I were in the room when the contract that was recently negotiated by Chair Powell and Regent Sviggum with the president. And instead of two meetings, which is normally what they would do with the Regents Board, it just went through one meeting. In fact, Kenyanya, Regent Kenyanya, was actually out of the country, wasn't able to even attend. So I have a concern because the total amount of the contract now is 1.2 million over some time. It takes us some time to get there for the president. And our concern was that we were going to see other administration coming forward asking for an increase. And that has happened. And so we now have the AD now asking for additional money. And I'm sure there will be more to follow. Here's my concern. So you've asked for $935.6 million between bonding and additional budget, also $75 million each year in the tails going forward. So continuing appropriations, not just one time. And you total that up and it's quite near $1 billion. So I just had a conversation last night with a whole bunch of senators, and they're looking at the $7.7 billion surplus. And the folks that they're speaking to, that is most likely going to shrink with the February forecast. We will probably not have 7.7. So I have this is hard for me to have an ask that's quite near $1 billion when a contract was negotiated in the middle of the contract to a very high amount, $1.2 million. Now we've had additional administration ask for more money. You've cut 3 sports teams to try to save money. And now you've come here for an ask of nearly $1 billion. Now I know that this committee, we don't do bonding, right? So you just have to present to us because that's sort of how things go. But in totality, it's quite near $1 billion. And that's an awfully big ask out of a $7.7 billion surplus, which will be much smaller by the time we get to February forecast. So this is incredibly concerning to me, putting all of these pieces together. When I was at the December meeting of the Regent Board, there was literally an outcry from many people, including students, including the sports teams that were cut, the 3 different men's sports teams that were cut. There were union members there that were outraged at this increase. And so I present that as an incredibly huge concern about the amount of this ask. And I would just caution us moving forward and to keep that in mind as we make decisions moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Koznick has a question and Representative Cleburne then. On deck. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and President Gabel, thanks for being with us today. Sort of along those lines of Lead O'Neill, we had talked, you know, the ask is a significantly a large amount of money, but I remember being with you in September and kind of asked what the legislative priorities would be for the University of Minnesota. And I was a little surprised, but pleasantly at the answer that it was mostly just going to be HEPR funds to maintain the university. I know one thing that's changed since September to a recent forecast. What changed that increased the ask for the university at this point?
President Gabel.
How does this Zoom thing work again? Chair Bernardi, Senator Koznick. So the surplus made us think about what was the best case scenario for the projects that we want to accomplish under the strategic plan in terms of how we advance the university, where the needs of the state are, where some of our pain points are that we share, that if we get better, the state gets better, where, and I think at the end of the day, it was originally our plan to, you know, when we talked, that was our plan. Of course, things and the times we find ourselves in have been requiring us to be agile and flexible lately. And so, you know, things like cutting something and asking for something else. I mean, you all ask us to operate within our means. You all ask us to find ways to reduce our overhead. Those things happen in coexistence and in concurrence. You ask us to fight to retain high quality talent. There's a market for talent. And we renegotiate contracts in the same meeting in order to address that all the time, including the AD's contract, which we renegotiate every 2 years, which would be the same schedule that I'm on now too. So the thought is we make a large ask because there are resources and needs, and we don't negotiate against ourselves. If you all make your tough decisions, as we know you have to make, we understand completely, but we think it's probably in the best interest of the mission and goals that we share that we put everything on the table and we discuss it, and then you all make your choices. And we look forward to working with you and providing as much information as we can behind those choices so that you're fully informed.
Representative Koznick, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say I appreciate your forthrightness, President Gabel. And, you know, as a committee, we and as a legislature, you know, we have a surplus, but certainly everybody recognizes that and seems that the asks keep growing. And I guess it's a better situation to be in than to be facing a deficit. But I just want to recognize the fact for the committee that, you know, things, the ask has changed, and it is based on that we do have a surplus, and it's probably more pronounced. And we have to take that into consideration than what is the most urgent need. And so I don't fault you for increasing the ask, President Gabel. That is your job. I recognize that. But from our side of the table and for the recognition of the taxpayers who paid in all our revenues, but certainly we have a surplus because of our hardworking taxpayers, we have to balance that need and return, in my opinion, a lot of those dollars, if not all, to them. So thank you for the clarity, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And President Gabel, I would like to say to you, thank you for being here. To me, this conversation today is refreshing. I am constantly asking, what does the university actually need? And to Representative Kosnick, it is important that these numbers are on the table. And I appreciate his comments as well. The piece that we always leave out of that conversation is, well, what do these dollars generate, right? And you brought part of that to the conversation as it was introduced, knowing that we were at a limited time. But when we make these investments and we make these innovations, we bring forward these innovations for our state, these dollars multiply multiple times. And so I want to thank you for bringing these numbers forward. For the committee, I just want to make sure that everybody understands the university president is responsible for a $4 billion annual budget. And then the president has to navigate these $3 billion of restricted endowment funds. So that there's always a dance about that. But when you talk about the chief executive officer, the president of our university, I would hope that we would make those apples to apples comparisons. What does the chief executive of a $7 billion corporation get paid? We are seeing in education how we're losing teachers to private business, and we want to make sure that we always have high caliber talent running our largest institution of the state. And I also want to remind people that the dollars that are spent at the University of Minnesota are not being spent on some entity that doesn't belong to the state. This is the state land grant institution, and these are dollars that benefit everyone in our state, and we can't lose sight of that. So these are taxpayer dollars going to taxpayer assets, taxpayer benefits. Overall that benefit everyone in our state. So I just want to say thank you. And I look forward to the conversations that we're going to have as we negotiate this budget going forward. But thank you for the honest and open conversation today.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left. So Representative Albright, we need to wrap up within 2 minutes. So please proceed.
I'll be quick. The first question is to my dear friend, Myron Franz. Mr. Franz, good to see you again. I note that in the governor's recommendations, there is quite a large disparity between his recommendations for the University of Minnesota as was not present or was pumped up a little bit, if you will, in your pitch. And so my question is, what's driving that difference? And I have a follow-on comment, Chair.
Okay, we have 1 minute here, Myron Franz. Go ahead, please proceed.
Well, thank you for the question, Representative. Good to see you too. You know, obviously this is a process, and I think you all know better than most that the process takes many courses. And I think one of the items we found out was that the governor was extremely interested in the scholarship programs, making sure that we have these recurring funds to make Minnesota more affordable to more Minnesota families. So that was one of the big pluses we got out of there, plus the amount of money for student services. I fully expect that this committee, upon reviewing the tremendous opportunities we're putting in front of you to help the people of Minnesota. We'll fully embrace this entire request. I mean, we didn't do this other than the fact that we want to help the University of Minnesota be a leader and a driver in what makes Minnesota great, what provides opportunities for families in Minnesota, whether it's education, research. So we're really excited about this, and we look forward to partnering with you on coming to the right conclusion at the end of the session.
Okay, and it is 4:30, and I apologize, we are not going to be able to continue on, but I'm at Representative Albright, if you could talk with my, I don't know what his title is now, Senior Vice President Franz, outside the committee, that would be great. So thank you, everyone. I want to let you know that our meeting will be, next meeting will be February 9th, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.